January 7th, 2020. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I don't know. It's I don't even know what to say anymore. So I guess I was looking at a Twitter feed this morning, and I just want to just read you the opening piece. It's a thread, and so it's a whole series of conversations. Mm-hmm. Reza Marashi, I've got to find out exactly what Reza's background is. Over the past few days, I've spoken extensively with career U.S. government officials as they've worked around the clock to try and mitigate the damage from Trump's ineptitude on Iran. With their permission, I'm sharing a small taste from our lengthy conversations. Enjoy. I'm just going to read you three. We have no functional national security decision-making process in place. We have no plan for what comes next. They are woefully unprepared for what's about to pop off, and they're too stupid to realize it. People here are freaking out, and rightfully so. Yeah. Next thread. We're still trying to dig out from underneath the last war of choice, and now they're trying to start a new one. I finally cracked open the bottle of scotch you gave me that I've been keeping stashed away in my desk drawer. How about this one? I'm going to call you later tonight to talk through this so I can get into meetings tomorrow armed with some sane talking points to insert into this cluster. You know what the rest of the word is. And then last but not least, when did most of us find out about killing Soleimani? After it already happened. Since then, we've been trying to cobble together contingency planning on the fly. But these charlatans ignore most of it. And then Trump does more stupid you-know-what that puts us back at square one. There's about 20 of these in the thread, of the 20 different individuals that he talked to. Wow. And it is, I mean, it's how do I say this? It's what you know, but you don't want to kind of, you just don't want to believe it. It's unbelievable. Anyway, I'm terrified. I'm terrified. And yeah. I'm excited about talking to David Dayan because David wrote this piece about the 2020 primary. And I wrote him a note this morning and said, but you wrote this before Iran. Does this change your calculus as you begin to evaluate the candidates? It's going to be very interesting. Anyway,
right. Totally your thoughts. Different. Well, you know, the way the U.S. government makes policy with the president consulting or not consulting or hearing voices that he only wants to hear or hearing a broad spectrum or having a guard dog like H.R. Haldeman or Al Haig, whoever it was, with different presidents that keep other voices away from the president is very similar to the legislative process. As you know, Arnie, as a former legislator, you know how the sausage is made is a lot uglier than just reading the statute after it's passed and reading it like it's the gospel. You know, the courts interpret the statute exactly as written and make assumptions that the legislators must have put this provision intending to be consistent with the other provisions.
A lobbyist put that provision in, and they didn't know because it was after they actually almost passed it.
Right, and not to mention some people add provisions that are inconsistent with the other provisions precisely to make it a little more to their liking. That stuff is just kind of this is a scary lesson for U.S. citizens to realize that you can't just look at our government the way it's taught in textbooks. It's really a sausage-making process, and things happen. I mean, I remember all the stories about the uniform bill at the end when they put everything together and lobbyists put all their bells and whistles. You know, here's several million dollars of pork in a state one, and here's a gift to the big pharma.
And it gets put in the last minute because that's when everyone's exhausted. The public hearings are over. Now realize, what was the public hearing for? It was a joke. It's never about the public hearing. It's about what the lobbyist gets to do at the last minute to manipulate the outcome.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying. And then you add your poison pills, too. In fact, that's how – did you know this, Arnie, that Title VII, the 1964 Civil Rights Act that provided for equality in employment was race, ethnicity, national origin, religion – the Southerners, who opposed racial non-discrimination, the Southerners added sex, gender, as a category, as a poison pill, because they thought nobody would ever agree not to discriminate against women. So, you know, it was added as a poison pill. Now it's the greatest tool for giving women equality or some modicum of equality, less inequality in the workplace.
Well, sometimes you don't play at the consequences of your actions because you make certain assumptions that are so incredibly wrong.
Yeah. So anyway, that's just a comment on what you were talking about. I also wanted to say today I heard a discussion of the new movie Little Women by Greta Gerwig, and It sounds amazing, Arnie, because, I don't know, all through my life I have thought of Little Women as a book about women as people, but more from a romantic and a relationship
a with
each other
yeah,
kind
exactly,
of point
exactly,
of view.
Exactly.
And this interpretation, Gehrig's interpretation of it, is all about sexism,
yeah.
It seems. I can't have a life as a woman.
That was Amy. You heard the quote from Amy where Amy's basically saying, I'm marrying for money.
Yeah.
Because I'm not allowed to earn it.
Yeah, yeah.
I know, I love it. I don't have property, only you do. Oh.
And just think about all of that. I mean, that is the way girls, yeah. young women were raised
right.
back then in the old days. But it's also
the
way
days.
Women were raised in this
But let me be
year.
Honest with you. Let's talk a little bit about this, and then we have to get to our first guest. But I've always said to people that marriage is an interesting thing. It, you know, we have this idea that it's about love. For a lot of people, it's about a lot of other things. It's about power. It's mm-hmm. about money. It's about stability. For me, a marriage was about, you know, Marty's health insurance plan. I used to introduce him as a health. So the idea that it's mm-hmm. not a financial contract is somewhat naive. It's changed a little because now women can actually own property. They can actually, but still to a large extent, they're never as economically stable as men. So
right.
that's a consideration. I remember when mm-hmm. I was dating Marty, one of my friends who's a lawyer said, "Don't marry him until I get to look at his portfolio." I mean, that's exactly what he said. Holy moly. And that was 2000s, you know? I just
so much for romance,
know.
Huh?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah,
but it's not just marrying for the money and the marriage stuff, but also employment. The part about her as a woman not being able to be taken seriously as any worker, and especially a writer who can
right.
think for herself,
right. Right.
and making her own deal with the publishing company and all of that, it's really quite amazing how Louisa May Alcott pre-warned us about
right.
all of the issues that are still problems
right.
today.
Exactly.
Almost, you know, 150 years later. It's
wow.
unbelievable.
Well, I know, we have to go to our first guest. Yeah, but you know, as I'm thinking about this, remember I told you, I called my mother up in 1991 to tell her I was running for governor. My mother got quiet, and then she said, "You can't." This is 1991. This is not Louisa May Alcott. This is
yeah.
not the 1800s. 1991. And I said, "Excuse me, I can't? Why can't I run for governor?" "Because you'll embarrass the family." 1991. Let me repeat that. 1991. I could write Little Women. So there are so many things going on in this world that are just catastrophic. And I know that, you know, we're all talking about impeachment. The Congress is back in session. I know we're talking about Iran. I'm looking at what's happening in Australia, and I'm absolutely beyond frightened. Then I wake up this morning and I see that there is an earthquake in Puerto Rico. Oh my God. Oh my God. I mean, it's like Puerto Rico they can't get a break. They can't get a break. And, but I go to theconversation.com a lot, and you know that because I wax poetic about it. And I love it because it brings me new content that I wouldn't necessarily read in, you know, U.S. News and World Report or read in the New York Times. And yet I think it's so important. And, I am worried about climate change. And what I put out as I was putting out today's conversation about what we're going to be having is I wrote this, part one, despite impeachment, Iranian assassinations, Bolton's offer to testify, Iowa caucus just around the corner, February 3rd, the climate change / crisis is the apocalyptic challenge we all face as a planet. Joining us right now on the line is my first guest. She wrote a piece at theconversation.com entitled "Statistic of the Decade, The Massive Deforestation of the Amazon." About 24,000 square miles of Amazon rainforest have been deforested over the last decade. Let me welcome now Professor Liberty, is it Vitert? How do you pronounce your last name?
Perfect.
Perfect.
Littered.
So you are amazing. I want my audience to know a little bit about your bio, because I normally just write like a couple of a sentence or two, and I say professor of the practice of data science, Washington University. And I realize as I read your bio at the conversation, I'm like, holy moly, no. So tell me a little bit about Liberty, because I think people need to understand both your wealth of experience, what you have done, and why you truly understood how they chose the statistic, because you were one of the people to make the choice.
Well, that's very kind of you. I think you need to be my publicist.
Okay,
too.
I will.
But you know, really, my work has been in how we understand the world through numbers and through statistics, and trying to help. You know, visualization and trying to, you know, these numbers can be so overwhelming and so big. You see statistics every day in the news, and, you know, we really just believe them because we see these numbers.
Right.
And a lot of times they're misused and they're wrong. So one of the real efforts of the Rail Statistical Society and this Statistic of the Decade is to try to help people really understand what these numbers mean and have a real insight into these issues that we're facing.
So Ken, my producer, has heard me say this over and over again. I describe myself as a politician in recovery. But if I ever ran again, I would run on three words. Do the math. Do the math. Because I think there is power in numbers if they're used accurately, if they're used in context, if they are a way for us to understand and visualize what's actually happening. And that's why I so appreciate what you do. And as you were talking, I couldn't stop laughing because I really do see that there is significant power in these numbers, but they need to be sort of put into some sort of a portfolio that we can then understand. So explain to me about how you chose this statistic of the decade. Who offered you suggestions? Who's on the panel? And how did the Amazon rise to the top?
So the Royal Statistical Society panel is made up of about 10 people who the Royal Statistical Society has decided should choose sort of the zeitgeist of the decade, if you will. It's similar to Oxford Dictionary's, you know, word of the year.
Yes, exactly.
But we really, you know, as the new decade approaches, we decided to have the statistic of the decade. And people submit it from all over the world. We get submissions of
okay.
what should be this international statistic of the decade, what really captures what we have faced in this past decade. And it was frankly a pretty easy decision. You know, this is really an insight into, you know, one of the decade's worst environmental degradations. And it, you know, the actual statistic of the decade was 8.4 million, and that's the number of soccer fields that has been deforested in the Amazon just over the past decade, which for American football viewers, that would be 10.3 million football fields. Or, I mean, another way to look at it is that's the size of Connecticut, Hawaii, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. And it takes that number of 24,000 square miles and really makes it something that you can understand, and it's just stunning when you really think about it.
Well, you write in your piece, since 2010, mile upon mile of rainforest has been replaced with a wide range of commercial developments, including cattle ranching, logging, and the palm oil industry. So let's talk a little bit about what is the sort of raison d'être. I mean, I'm looking at the fires in Australia, and it's apocalyptic, okay?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of reasons for this. It isn't just because they've been mining coal. I mean, this is really the beginning of the consequence of the climate crisis, and you're beginning to see it happen everywhere. But this is so interesting because everybody has talked about the Amazon as being sort of the lungs of the planet, and yet for whatever reason, this was an intentional decision to deforest because they were looking at the economic benefit of what they were going to get from the cattle ranching and the palm oil. And since they didn't necessarily look at the gestalt of the planet, they were saying, this is better for us. But you, in your statistics, look at this and say, actually, it probably isn't, even financially, for the moment.
Exactly. I find one of the easiest ways to argue against the financial gain argument of climate change to say, well, what's the financial loss?
Right.
You know, let's compare these actual numbers instead of just debating the climate crisis. So, you know, President Bolsonaro, Brazil's president, has really sort of this short-term view of financial gain. So they're deforesting the Amazon mainly for cattle ranching. That's
right.
Really the main thing. And it's about a $20 billion gain for Brazil. For the amount of, you know, the acres that over the past decade that have been deforested, it's about a $20 billion gain. But if you look at the financial loss side, so, you know, you look at the people that depend on the rainforest that have to, you know, either get state money or go do something else, the water, the droughts that it causes, the carbon that it doesn't store anymore, simply what the Amazon could generate from nut farming or rubber or something besides the cattle farming, we get to almost $7.8 trillion that are lost because of this deforestation. And $20 billion pales. It's chump change compared to what's lost.
Yeah, but Liberty, let's be honest here. That trillion that you're talking about is the worldwide economic consequences of losing these football fields of the Amazon. What this president of Brazil is focusing on is, you know, you talk about the fact that he's looking at the immediacy of the moment, but the immediacy of the moment is change in his coffers, not what is happening on the planet. He doesn't really care about the benefits to the world. He cares about the benefits to Brazil. I have always said over and over again that my goal would be to buy up every coal, oil, and gas company on the planet and say, how much do you want for it? Here's the check. I mean, we spend trillions on war. Why not look at the war on the climate and say, okay, I'll cut the check. I mean, I understand that money talks. So as you brought this up, it's a statistic of the decade. Is it beginning to filter into Brazil that they are now actually undermining their economic stability? Even if they're looking at the moment isn't going to last very long.
Absolutely. Farmers are struggling unfathomably because of the droughts. Coffee farmers, they're losing just enormous amounts of money every year because of this. And yes, you're completely right that President Bolsonaro cares about, money in his coffers versus the rest of the world. But, there's studies that show that, the Amazon could generate $8 billion for Brazil if it was just through nut farming and rubber. It's money in the coffers, but it's also the people pushing, that the cattle ranchers and cattle farmers have a whole heck of a lot more power than the nut farmers and the rubber farmers, especially because a lot of U.S. farmers are going to Brazil to buy land. It's way cheaper. An acre of Brazil land is way cheaper than an acre of U.S. farmland.
Excuse me, you have
these outside pressures.
Ken?
Liberty, isn't there also an issue of externalities? Because Brazil, which I guess can make the decisions over its own sovereign Amazon, gains by the $20 billion you mentioned, but it's the whole rest of the world that loses the $7.8 trillion. So the people that make the profits are not the same people as who make the losses. Is there a way to incorporate some of those costs?
I'm thinking, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking of a GoFundMe for Brazil.
But as
we're talking about this, I mean, one of the things I always thought about with the Amazon, not just that it's the lungs of the planet, but that the pharmaceutical industry has gone into the Amazon and found so many quote-unquote potential cures because of what they were able to find there. You would think that all these groups that understand the value of the Amazon as a rainforest, not as what it's being turned into by its loss by football field every minute, that they would, come together as a collection and say, listen, is there a way for us to monetize the preservation of these forests?
I think that sounds like a spectacular idea, and sign me up. I'll be right there with you.
But why aren't we thinking like that?
Pharmaceutical company.
Right. No. But Liberty, I mean, think about, I am actually thinking about all these organizations that understand it because they do play out the consequences. I'm thinking, but if they calculated what their loss is, then they can actually put a value on it. And I think that there is, I mean, money does talk. I'm an old environmentalist. You know what we learned many, many years ago? How do we get people to recycle? We told them we're going to put 10 cents on a bottle or a can. And you're not going to throw away 10 cents, but you will throw away a bottle or a can. So we've understood that monetizing things does change behavior. As we are lamenting this loss of the Amazon, how come the world hasn't come together to figure out, so what is the monetization of this to sort of change the result? You talk about the numbers. So as you were looking at these statistics, have you also calculated what the cost would be to actually save it?
And Arnie, that's what economists talk about as internalizing the external costs.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I absolutely love that idea, and I didn't have to be totally honest and say I didn't really think about it. It's about $2,000 an acre to really sort of save the Amazon is the way you could think about it.
Right.
And that would be an incredible way to sort of think through how you could do that. That's sort of currently above my pay grade, but it's brilliant, and I would love to think about that.
Well, I think we're at a point right now where we understand the power of money. And, you know, I mean, we're going to be covering the 2020 campaign right after you, Liberty. And one of the things that's so interesting to me is now we've got dueling billionaires in this campaign. And I'm looking at Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg. And this is on the Democratic side where, you know, they're talking about wealth taxes, not the eight billionaires. And yet we've got these two billionaires that are running. And yet I also see the ability of that money to be able to punch through in a way that I am not capable of doing because I have to raise it and I have to organize people and I have to sort of genuflect to whoever that is supporting me in order to make sure that the policies resonate with them. A billionaire is a benevolent despot. They can do whatever they want. And yet I'm looking at your statistic about the Amazon, and to me, it is the clarion cry to say, then we need to figure out how to save it. And it's not just Brazil that has to make this decision. It is all of us. But we have to then replace that loss of dollars for Brazil because there is some understanding that there are economic consequences, but the climate consequence far outweighs the economic short-term consequence for us to pay for this.
Absolutely.
Oh, God. So as you do these statistical things with this group, how do you what came in second? I just need to kind of – I'm kind of curious. And the Amazon was so obvious, and we keep hearing about the lungs of the earth. But what came in second or third as you were looking at all these things that would define the decade?
You know, it's so interesting you asked that. We chose one highly commended, you know, sort of – or two highly commended international statistics of the decade. And the one that was most interesting to me was 19%. And the global, you know, so the age standardized death rate from air pollution fell by 19% over the decade, which to me, when I read it, was shocking. Because, you know, I would have thought, someone had said, you know, do you think air pollution's getting, you know, deaths from air pollution are getting worse or better? I'd say, oh, well, way worse. And it's actually fallen by 42% over the past 30 years. So, you know, there is hope. I guess, you know, the one issue with the climate crisis is that we only hear about the crisis. We right. only hear the bad things. Right. And we as human beings have trouble when we only hear doom and gloom. Right. And there is hope. You know, there are things that are happening that are good. Wow. And this is one of them.
And that hope can be an incentive for people to say, yeah, it's not just doom and gloom. Climate change is going to kill us. We can actually do this.
Well, and it shows that human action and human activity makes a difference.
Yeah.
I got to ask that question about the 19%. And it's not that I want to sort of embrace gloom and doom, but my daughter lives in Shanghai. So let me tell you about China. Oh, my God. She has all kinds of masks, you know, the mask for the really bad days and then the sort of quasi-media mask and whatever. And as you were looking at that statistic, did that statistic begin to tweak because China is so quickly moving into this sort of high-tech industrial, everybody wants a car from a nation that used to walk or ride a bicycle? I'm just wondering whether that statistic was also beginning to sort of bend slightly.
That's a really interesting comment. One of the, you know, sort of the issue with saying a global statistic, you know, the whole world,
of course.
Is you don't break it down individually, you know, which countries are doing better.
Right.
And there are some countries that are doing unbelievably worse, but there are many countries that are doing a lot better.
Okay.
So it's sort of, you know, it evens out as some get worse, some get better. And if you really wanted to do it, you'd do a visualization of the whole, you know, a map of the whole world, and you'd say who's gone up and who's gone down.
Okay, you made me feel better. I got to think up. I got to think positive. Liberty Vitaut is at the Washington University in St. Louis. She is a statistician, statistic of the decade, the massive deforestation of the Amazon. You were so lucky. I'd like to be a little bird listening to the conversation as you made the decision and you picked out which one should be number one. Anyway, I can't even imagine what you were looking at. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, ciao. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little labor history, isn't it?
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day that President Jimmy Carter signed into law the Chrysler Corporation Loan Guarantee Act. The act allowed the federal government to guarantee up to $1.5 billion in loans to aid the failing Chrysler Corporation. The car giant had to find private financing for the loans, but had the promise of the federal government's backing. In the late 1970s, high gasoline prices had hit the domestic automobile industry hard. Japanese and European car manufacturers were increasing their market share by producing smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. By 1979, Chrysler's annual losses had soared toward $1 billion. In his remarks on the signing of the law, President Carter said, "It's important to have Chrysler preserved as a viable, competitive entity, not only to protect the jobs involved, but to protect the competitive nature of the American automobile manufacturing industry in its competition with foreign suppliers, and in the provision of good products at a competitive price for the American consumer." Officials from both Chrysler and the United Auto Workers helped to hammer out the deal in Washington. The loans helped save Chrysler, and the company did pay the money back. In 2008, the auto industry companies were once again helped by a federal bailout. Many working people have noted that the federal government seems much more quick to help corporations who fall on hard times rather than regular people. Folk musician Arlo Guthrie wrote a song capturing this very idea.
I am changing my name to Chrysler. I am going down to Washington, D.C. I will tell some power broker what they did. Iacocca will be perfectly acceptable to me. I am changing.
Like what you hear? Check out more at FaberHistoryIn2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At the Detroit Zoo, giraffes, rhinos, and zebras not only fascinate visitors, they also generate what the zoo calls poo power. Sustainability manager Rachel Hanbury explains.
Animal manure is very usable, has a lot of energy in it.
In 2017, the zoo became the first in the country to convert animal waste to clean energy. The animal manure, along with food waste, goes into what's called a biodigester. As the waste breaks down in this airtight environment, it releases methane-rich gas, which can then be used to generate electricity. The zoo is using that electricity to help power its animal hospital. The leftover solid waste can be used as compost for gardens throughout the zoo.
And we're 125 acres in size, so we use a lot of compost.
Hanbury says by putting animal and food waste to good use, the zoo is diverting about 500 tons of waste from landfills each year. Though biodigesters are fairly common on farms, only a handful of zoos around the world have started using them. But Hanbury says that's changing.
Zoos are reaching out to us all across the country because they want to do something similar.
It's part of a growing trend of keeping waste from going to waste. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Everyone, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little kind of craziness going on right now, but that's all right. So I love the American Prospect. And one of the people who was recently hired as their new, I guess it, executive editor, I think. Is that, was that, that, is that your title, David Dayan?
That's correct.
Right.
Is a gift
to the Prospect and a gift to us. So you wrote a piece recently that was entitled The Two or More Primaries. The old ways of thinking about Democratic primaries shed less light this year because of multiple candidates competing in multiple lanes. And I guess I'm trying to figure out whether there were a lot of candidates, no question about it. In a way, in the beginning, it was a celebration. We saw the most diverse array of candidates ever possible, and I was, like, so excited. But what I do need to tell you is that I think the biggest problem wasn't the multiple lanes or the multiple candidates. I think the biggest problem was that Biden and Bernie ran. And I wanted Biden and Bernie to sit it out as senior statesmen and not run this time. And then allow this multiple group of candidates to really begin to sort of refresh the bench and give us an opportunity to have a conversation that I think to some extent was directed from the very beginning, because these two names that we were very familiar with kind of directed the result.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true to a certain extent. You have sort of the last of the boomer elections going on.
Exactly. The last of the boomer elections, exactly.
Yeah.
And I wanted the boomers to know that. I'm like, go on.
And one thing that's interesting about that is that, you wouldn't think that Biden and Sanders are really competing for the same group of voters, but they are.
Yeah.
Despite their ideology, they really are competing on similar terrain around blue-collar voters, what has commonly, in Democratic primaries, been known as the beer track.
Right.
Blue-collar voters, people of color. In terms of age, it's different. Biden appeals to older voters, Sanders very much to younger voters. But it's similar in terms of class. And even somewhat similar in terms of race.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think you said in your piece that Buttigieg and Warren sort of appealed to the wine class.
The wine track. More wealthier, more upscale voters that traditionally in Democratic primaries had fallen short. The difference was Obama, who was sort of a wine track candidate, also had the benefit of a lot of support from the African-American community.
Yeah.
And that changed sort of how people thought about Democratic primaries.
Yeah, but that didn't happen until he won Iowa. It was when he won in white Iowa that, I mean, it was almost like the African-American community could not imagine that there'd be a president that would be a president of color. And all of a sudden, when white Iowa embraces Barack Obama, they're like, whoa, this is a dream we can actually imagine. We have permission.
That's absolutely correct. And to an extent, Hillary rebuilt that coalition a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have kind of a scramble. And these things, the whole wine track, beer track thing, the important thing is it's unrelated to ideology.
Yeah.
It's just who these candidates appeal to, sort of in a broader segmentation. But you could be more on the liberal side or more on the moderate side, and still have that kind of lane. The difference is now that ideology means a lot more in Democratic primaries.
But I think ideology does mean a lot more. And you pointed out to something where, I don't know, was it a Gallup poll or a Pew poll that basically says that the Democrats have gotten more liberal, progressive,
the rank and file.
Well, I think to a large extent, we learned our lesson after electing Bill Clinton. I mean, nobody really knew what a New Democrat was, but we should have understood that a New Democrat was a Republican, and that's what we. I mean,
they
always
told us what their policies were. It was clear they were Republican.
Well, it's interesting. I have to tell you the story as I go back to my first experience doing like elected politics as a candidate for governor. Was I remember calling my staff one day and saying, so who's this Bill Clinton guy? And they're like, what do you mean? Because remember, he was the third string Democrat. They basically thought Bush was going to win. He was a Bubba from Arkansas. Nobody ever imagined that Bill Clinton would become president. You know that and I know that. But I was really surprised by Bill Clinton. And my staff said, why are you surprised by him? And I said, how do you know he's a Democrat? And they said, what? And I said, every room he walks into, under one arm is the insurance lobbyist, and under the other arm is the banking lobbyist. The two lobbyists I've been fighting for 8 years. And I'm just so surprised that they're like holding his hand and he's running on the Democratic ticket. So that was 1991, David. You know, it took us a long time to understand what he was going to ultimately do to the Democratic Party. And now to whatever extent, we've been somewhat rehabilitated. And I think Bernie Sanders really kicked us in the pants and made a huge difference in 2015.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that definitely, you know, you have to also bring in the fact that Bernie was able to go through 2015 and 2016 mostly without having to rely on big dollar donations.
Yes.
And that has really transformed and opened up space for what you can talk about in a Democratic primary.
Didn't Obama do that too, David?
What's that?
Didn't Obama do that too by turning
down
federal money?
He did, but he still played the game. Obama's number one, the company that he received the most donations from. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I know. How did I know?
He still played the game. He went to the fundraisers. Bernie in 2016 went to a few, but largely not. He was really funded by the grassroots, and that's more so in 2020, and the same for Warren. And if you look at the year-end numbers, if you look at all of 2019, the top two candidates in terms of fundraising are Warren and Sanders being number one. And so they've proven the model. You don't have to rely on that, and that really affects what you can say and what you can propose.
Well, you know, I'm so jealous of the fact that they had social media. I mean, social media has made it so much easier to do the fundraising.
Right.
I mean, and I'll be honest with you. I always use myself because I'm the template that I know. We had more individual contributions than any campaign in history when I ran for governor. You know how hard that was to do? I can't even tell you. I mean, remember, this was like postage stamps and postcards and knocking on people's doors and saying, yes, I'll take that roll of pennies. But we had more individual contributions than any campaign had ever had. And it was kind of shocking because that was in 92 when, again, you were supposed to genuflect and have the high donor events and have the PACs and whatever. And we were trying back then to do a different model. What has been so powerful about social media, and that was beginning with Barack Obama, but then I think perfected by Bernie Sanders, is that it's real easy to get $18 many, many times because all you got to do is punch in your credit card and you're done.
Yeah. I mean, I'd go back even further. You know, Howard Dean putting up the bat really inventing online donations.
Right.
Even before that, Jerry Brown had the 800 number. You know, send me money with the 800 number in 1992. It's not like people, you know, just figured out that if you raise a lot of, a little bit of money from a lot of people, that would be powerful. It's just that the tools now are there to actually accomplish it.
So you talk about how the subtitle is the old ways of thinking about Democratic primaries shed less light this year because of multiple candidates competing in multiple lanes. So I'm looking at this primary and I'm trying to figure out, hasn't there always been multiple lanes? I mean, has there always been the sort of more conservative candidate, the more...
Well, there has, but the point I was trying to make is that usually the sort of beer track, wine track conception was enough. You know, if there were more Democrats at the lower end of the income ladder, and if you could dominate the sort of beer track lane, you would win. And that proved true for a long time, only interrupted by the fact that Barack Obama was able to pair African American support with more wine track, you know, educated upper class. But there have been changes in the party. The party has appealed more on the basis of ideology, and the party has lost some of those lower downscale voters. Mm-hmm. They've moved over to the Republicans. So that means that typical analysis doesn't really work anymore. And you see it this year because you have sort of four candidates that are occupying all four quadrants here. You have a more moderate beer track candidate in Biden, a much more progressive one in Sanders. You have a more progressive wine track candidate in Warren, right, and a more moderate one in Buttigieg. And that sort of square means that a lot of the primary voting population is split up. And so that's going to be the interesting thing to see, that who can cobble together the winning coalition.
Can I ask a question, David? On your analysis, how do you explain 1968, which I think was maybe the year that the Democratic Party really changed, and all of politics changed, both within the Democratic Party and versus Republicans in the general? Because there certainly was a ideological, the liberals, if you will, anti-war candidates, McCarthy and Kennedy versus Hubert Humphrey, and we all saw how that turned out. With
I would argue that it's hard to really put a modern lens on a primary like 68, which did not have as many primary elections around the country. I mean, the primary rules as we know them today came into being afterwards, you know, with the McGovern reforms. And so 72 is really the start of what a modern, you know, Democratic primary looks like, in 76 more so.
Well, there were still a bunch of them in 68, running, starting with New Hampshire in the beginning of February,
but there were,
and ending on June 5th.
They were scattered. I mean,
California.
Hubert Humphrey did not compete in any primary in that election.
Wow.
And yet won the nomination.
Yeah.
It was a different way of conceiving how the primary was.
So I wrote you a note this morning and I said, did you write your piece before what happened with the Iranian assassination? And I'm looking,
absolutely before.
I thought. So here's what I was looking at an article at TheIntercept.com, something that you've also written for in the past, but this is not your article. As Sanders and Warren vowed to block war with Iran, Biden and Buttigieg offer better run wars. And what I wrote, I posted this on Facebook, and I wrote the following as I posted it. I said, as you read this article, keep this explosive story released in December of 2019 in the back of your mind. The Afghanistan papers show that the U.S. officials misled the public about Afghanistan for almost 20 years. So let's talk a little bit about what has just happened with the assassination, because what was a foreign policy conversation had not even really been in any way, shape, or form part of the conversation with the 2020 candidates. It is very different between Bernie and Biden. Very different. I don't know what track that is, but that's
it's another fault line.
It's a huge fault line.
You're absolutely right. I'll plug The Prospect, because yesterday we had some really great coverage on Iran. So if you go to our website, the top of it, there are these trending topics, and the first one there is Iran. You can read all our coverage.
Okay.
But with respect to how this plays in the primary, I mean, you know, that's going to be fascinating, and it's going to dominate next week's debate.
Totally.
We'll really see where the Democratic electorate is, because they're going to have a pretty stark choice. I mean, Joe Biden is at the forefront of the establishment in foreign policy over the last 40 plus years, and we are seeing where that establishment leads us, which is more of a neoconservative direction. And for at least that long, Bernie Sanders has been on the opposite side of that. So, I mean, this is a really kind of a titanic struggle that we're going to see between these two competing conceptions. And, you know, sometimes these events create a sort of rallying effect, nationalistic effect, and sometimes they lead to revulsion, certainly in a party that you know, what we saw in 2008 was the party was pretty strongly anti-war. It took several years of Iraq to get there. The question is, you know, where is the party now?
Well, but this, I think this so hurts Biden. I think this so hurts Biden, because not only did he vote for the war in Iraq, but apparently he was giving a speech, I think it was in Iowa, where he basically kind of misled the audience as to the fact that no sooner did he vote for the war in Iraq than he was really opposed to it. And they were like, well, not exactly, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
no
and this is not a time for him to be inaccurate about his activity vis-a-vis foreign policy. But when you begin to realize what happened with impeachment, what drove impeachment? What it was because he was responsible for the Ukraine policy under Barack Obama, and his son, who got hired by a company because his last name was Biden, wanted to influence, you know, Ukrainian policy, even though there's no necessarily proof that that ultimately happened. But you and I both know why he went on the payroll. And I'm sort of looking at this and I'm thinking, this is the one place where what appears to be a strength for Biden is also just one minefield after another minefield, and who will be so effective at being able to respond to that is going to be Bernie more than anyone else, because he's not afraid to take on Biden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, you know, we saw just this morning Elizabeth Warren release her plan for bankruptcy, which is not so veiled.
Against Biden.
Shot at Joe Biden for
exactly.
being the you
the
know
credit card
the architect
company.
of the 2005 bankruptcy bill.
Right.
So we're going to see more of this very direct contrast between Biden and certainly between Warren and Sanders and Biden. And you know, it speaks right to electability.
Well, and that's where I was going to go. So let's talk about that term, electability. Is that even valid anymore?
No.
I mean, I don't think it ever has been.
I don't think it ever has been. I mean, if you look at who the candidates were nominated on the basis of that they were more electable, you'd have to be talking about John Kerry and Michael Dukakis.
Exactly.
And to an extent, Walter Mondale. I mean, it never works. But if you want to have a larger conception of electability, you have to go to record and how that record can be employed in a general election. And, you know, you look at Biden's record, his service on behalf of banking interests and foreign policy imperialists. And, I don't know that that's where the country is right now.
So as we're moving forward, because I mean we're talking February 3rd, I believe, is the caucus. One of the other things that we're now hearing more than ever is because of the changing demographic, David. Everyone is saying, why does it make sense for Iowa and New Hampshire to be first? And let me say one thing that I think is valid, and it's not
Don't
our
get
whiteness.
In trouble here
No.
In New Hampshire.
I know, but it's not our whiteness. What it is that there is still some value to retail politics. And that doesn't happen in California. That doesn't happen in Texas. That doesn't happen in New York. And I see how the media asks questions of candidates, and then I see how John Q. Public asks questions of the candidates, and they're not the same. They don't have the same
right.
filter. They're not worried about losing access, you know, all that other crap. And they're willing to sort of say, you didn't answer my question, you know? So I'm just trying to figure out, how do we listen to what Julian Castro said, because he was so ticked off about really not being able to sort of generate some sort of enthusiasm for him. But I'm not sure that it was New Hampshire's fault because it's white or Iowa's fault that it's white, that Julian didn't necessarily rise to the top.
Well, I mean, I'm of two minds about this. Okay. I take your point about retail politics. I don't necessarily think that that demands that those retail politics take place in Iowa and New Hampshire.
No, I mean, no, I hear you.
Most of the population, particularly the Democratic population of Nevada, is in one city. And so, you know, you certainly can do retail politics in other states. I have long believed that the best way to conduct this primary is on a rotating regional basis, where regions of the country, maybe there's a way to do a couple states first to get that retail politics feel, but you rotate the rest so everybody gets a chance to be first and you know, you do it in a balanced way so it reflects the diversity and the demographics of the party.
All right, last but not least. So she hasn't sent over the articles of impeachment yet. So obviously we're all sort of waiting with bated breath. Someone sent me an email this morning because I saw that you were coming on and just asked me to ask you, so what the heck's going on with Bolton? With Bolton, because Bolton has now said that, you know, send me a subpoena and I'll show up. And I'm thinking, really, your lawyer told the House that you weren't going to show up. What changed other than maybe Soleimani, which is now, you know, it's like his wet dream. That's exactly what he wanted. He wants to go to war in Iran.
You know, so what's going to that would argue to? That he wouldn't want to, you know, rock the boat with Trump.
Exactly.
You know, I think that ultimately that's kind of a hollow comment.
Okay.
That, you know, he knows that it's that the Republicans are in control of the terms of the trial, and that it's really up to McConnell essentially to make that determination. I don't think there are enough dissidents in the Senate Republican caucus for it to matter terribly much. So whatever McConnell wants, he's going to get in terms of what the structure of that trial is going to look like.
So Bolton wins either way. So Bolton kind of says, look at this. I made myself
I'll do it if you ask me is not much of a commitment,
it's
right?
Not it's much. Exactly. Sort of, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, the only reason I asked the question was, I mean, there is a way for Nancy Pelosi to say, okay, we'll issue the subpoena. I mean, they haven't sent over the articles of impeachment. They're still sitting on it, which means, and to some extent, the House still has, you know, it's still in their purview. They could sort of say, well, now that you feel receptive to this, I don't want to wait for Mitch since he's not going to tell me how he's going to operate. I can operate. Here's the subpoena. Show up.
Right. Well, one other question is whether the assassination of a foreign leader on foreign soil constitutes another article.
Wow.
And we have a piece about that by Bruce Ackerman of Yale Law School, who says, absolutely, that's an impeachable offense.
Oh, this is getting so exciting. I'm getting so confused. Anyway, David Dayan, thank you so much for joining us. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see what ultimately rises to the top, both in New Hampshire and Iowa. And who knows? You know, that what is always predictable never shows up in Iowa. So it'll be kind of interesting to see.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. It's going to be totally wild. I'm telling you, I think Bolton was brilliant by saying, yes, I will accept a subpoena. Mm-hmm. And I think to a large extent, I think he is the wild card, because what Donald Trump did is something he has wanted forever. Mm-hmm. And people think that, you know, Bolton had access and information to so many things. I think it could be a wet kiss to Donald Trump if he showed up. I don't trust him as far as I can see.
That's what I was going to say when David started answering your question about Bolton was, do you trust what he'll testify to?
Yeah.
Because we all think, you and me, law-abiding people, you know, we think that you're subpoenaed to testify in court, you're going to testify to the truth and what you know and what you've seen, and maybe you'll try to be as opaque as you can, not only the answer to the question asked, but you're not going to totally change your story. And Bolton could totally change his story because now he's got the military aggressiveness that he wants.
It's everything he's ever wanted. And to think that it's Donald Trump that delivered is just kind of shocking, given everything that Donald Trump said during the course of the campaign. No more wars. Bring them home. Bring them home. Of course, that was Donald Trump's rhetoric, and it was always a lie. Anyway, and we're going to sing a song, or we're going to play the song Red Rain. Tell you a little about that.
I was going to say, by the way, that Bruce Ackerman, who's going to testify, was my mentor at Yale Law School.
Well, there you go. See, now we all have to go to theprospect.org.
And he testified in the Clinton.
And he said it's another impeachable act. I love it. So what's Red Rain? Well, we'll play it.
It's a good song.